Hi, this is Aaron from Gangland Wire. You're going to want to join me and Gary Jenkins for the 2018 Mob Summit in Las Vegas. That's right, folks. Las Vegas, baby. We're going to be there June 15th, 16th, and 17th. Three crime-filled days with author Frank Culotta. Gary Jenkins is going to be there as well, speaking about his app, talking about his movie, sharing his book, Leaving Vegas. And then Larry Henry of the Mafia Chronicles is going to be there as well, and many, many more. We're spending Friday evening mixing with the mob at the Plaza Hotel. Saturday from 9 to 1, we're in panel discussions about the mob. Saturday night, we're going to be rubbing elbows at the Mob Museum, and it continues Sunday from 9 to 1 p.m. at the Plaza Hotel in Las Vegas, baby. It's the 2018 Mob Summit.
My name is Harry Jones, and I'm a former reporter for the Kansas City Star. And you're listening to Gangland Wire.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, all you wiretappers out there. Welcome to the Classic Old Ice House building in Midtown Kansas City. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, wiretappers, we have a special guest tonight. We're doing another telephone interview, and you will be most interested if you ever listen to our seven-part series with the skyjacker, the parachuting skyjacker, Martin J. McNally. Why, you will really be interested in what our guest has to say tonight. This is David. He only wants to be known by kind of a nom de plume or a nom de guerre, whichever you want, a name of the pen or name of the sword or name of the war, rather, or name you use in war. Probably more of a name you use in war, nom de guerre.
Nom de tube.
Nom de tube. Nom de. He has a YouTube channel called As the Key Turns, and he is a former corrections officer, spent 23 years at the Federal Penitentiary in Marion, Illinois. It was I believe it was a maximum security facility when he was there, and he saw, in those 23 years, he saw many, many famous prisoners come and go, among which was our good friend, former guest, convicted skyjacker Martin J. McNally. He had a lot of interaction with Mac. So he's going to talk about Mac. He also saw John Gotti come in here and has some pretty good stories on John Gotti and several other really well-known mob guys. He was there when Pete Rose was there. So, David, we really appreciate you coming on the podcast. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So, David, 23 years at Marion. I'm a little curious about your background. Did you start out at Marion?
I did with the Federal Bureau of Prisons. I was in the military police when I was in the Army. I was a police officer on the street for a while, and those are the things that qualified me to get a job with the Bureau of Prisons.
Remind me, it was the main maximum security after Alcatraz. Is that correct?
Yeah. What happened is when Alcatraz closed, there was a gap in there of 6 to 8 months. So all the prisoners that were in Alcatraz were spread throughout the Bureau, and then USP Marion opened up. And what happened was those inmates would cause problems, and then they would be transferred to Marion. There was very few, as far as recidivism went, from either Alcatraz or Marion. We usually cured you enough that you could fly right and stay incident-free in other prisons. It did happen. I've met a couple of people from Alcatraz. But it was pretty rare, and they called us a supermax toward the end. About 1984, or thereabouts, they changed the mission to what they called a supermax, and everything was locked down. You were in your cells for 23 to 23 and a half hours a day. It became extremely restrictive, and then they used that example to make, quote, supermax, unquote, prisons in the state and even international. There's other prisons in the world now that are called supermax, and based on our model.
And so that would have been where they put not only the most physically dangerous prisoners, but also what they considered, what the government considered was the most dangerous to society prisoners, I would say, and the ones they wanted to make more of an example of, like spies would. I think maybe Aldrich Ames was put in there, the CIA spy, and the FBI agent Hansen. It seemed like maybe they were put in there, as well as John Gotti, who wasn't really a physical danger to anybody else, but he was more, I think they felt he's more of a danger to society, and want to send a message out to other mob guys, as well as all the really, really bad, dangerous characters like the Aryan Brotherhood and Black Guerrilla Family and people like that.
Oh, yeah, we got the head of all the prison gangs. So people like the ABs, we got they called them the Commission. When I was there, there was the three guys called Barry Mills, Tyler Bingham, and John Greshner. And they ran the Aryan Brotherhood, which by far is the most powerful prison gang in the federal system and maybe prisons in general. They're like the mafia of prisons. The mafia may run places on the outside in, say, New York, that kind of thing, but on the inside, behind the wire, over the wall, it's the Aryan Brotherhood. They're the big cheese of there. So with Barry Mills and Tyler Bingham and John Greshner inside prison, they're probably as famous as John Gotti, maybe more famous.
So, yeah, and we'll get more into this. What I've read about John Gotti is he basically paid the Aryan Brotherhood for their protection and in a way for the right to be there and be somewhat unmolested while he was in the penitentiary.
Yeah, I've heard the rumor. I'm not able to sit at their table and discuss it with them, but I can tell you that he did sit with members of the commission, in my view, in, say, the chow hall, and they had some spirited discussions. Now, what exactly they were talking about, well, they certainly would never have told me. Matter of fact, Gotti went out of his way not to speak to me about anything that didn't have to do with the immediate purpose.
Interesting.
He would talk to me about, he didn't like us. He considered us the police, the cops, and he's just not going to discuss anything with us if he don't have to.
Now, I'm thinking, let's start with our friend Martin J. McNally. I want to talk about him first. When what he told us, he was in Leavenworth for quite a while before he went to Marion. So Leavenworth, which is down here by Kansas City, that was, I know behind the walls, they have a farm and a behind the walls set up at Marion. It was reasonably maximum security, I think, and they send a lot of bad characters there. And he got transferred to Marion for some reason. I'm not sure why. Do you know anything about that?
No, I can tell you that generally, as far as I know, God is the only person that I knew that was ever assigned to us by the federal court. Everyone else has to earn their way there. McNally would be another one. I'm sure, knowing him, he was doing something, some scam, some something, and he got caught or in trouble or somebody snitched him out, and he ended up earning a bus ticket to Marion. And I can tell you, once he was at Marion, he was involved in at least two attempted escapes. One was by helicopter. He used to sit in his cell. Here's what made him the most dangerous, in my opinion. He would sit in his cell, and he would constantly be reading something, studying something, considering something. He's a pretty intellectual fellow. And he would turn that knowledge of some of the most oddball esoteric stuff into something that would scam us, you know, a way to communicate that no one had ever thought of before, a way to sneak information from one area to another that hadn't been done by anyone else, those kinds of things. And it's that kind of stuff that got him sent to Marion. It's like you were talking about, there's these people that are a danger to society, not necessarily from their physical presence, like they wouldn't stab you or shoot you, although McNally might. It was because they were so smart as to figure a new way to do the old stuff, and we weren't prepared for it, or somebody else wasn't prepared for it. And that's really what McNally was there for, because before them, who would have ever thought about, yeah, let's steal a helicopter and swoop into a prison and fly away? That never happened before. They were unprepared for that. Or the next one was, maybe we'll talk some lady into believing that she is got a real desire to help someone escape from prison, so she's going to hijack an aircraft and fly it to the local airport. I mean, he was involved in that kind of stuff.
Well, just
unbelievable. Right out of a movie.
Part of that was his association with Brock Trapnell, where he had...
Yeah, that was all... was all through Trapnell, and them two sit around and thought up this kind of stuff.
Now, realize that Martin does listen to the podcast,
yeah,
and
really.
He may come back at the bottom of the comment section in this episode and dispute some of what you say. Not that what you're saying isn't true from your perspective, but just realize that he does... listen and comment at times on the podcast. And
Mac, we know you're out there.
And he has a nice collection of books at his, where he lives.
He is an interesting guy.
It's fine. It's from my perspective, he was at Marion because he was just too damn bright for anybody else to really handle.
I can believe that. He is a bright guy.
He's a problem child. He's a problem child, and you got to have somebody sitting there watching him. Otherwise... something's going to happen.
Well, I know when we interviewed him at the end, he gave us a parting gift of a knife, and he commented that it was better to be caught with a knife than without one.
That was probably true everywhere, Marion especially.
Now, if he had given us a handmade shank, now that would have been phenomenal.
That would have been perfect, wouldn't it, Aaron?
I mean, I still carry the knife that he gave me because I took his advice to heart after I got robbed.
So, David... let's go back to, you talked about the escape attempts, and that was before that you were there. And Mac told us pretty much in detail how that went down. It was really kind of funny in a way how they, when the helicopter started to land by the yellow raincoat, all of a sudden it veered off, and that's when the helicopter pilot had gotten the gun away from the woman who skyjacked him and shot her. Why, he said he scrambled back over a roof trying to get back down to the yard, and as he dropped into the yard, a correctional officer walked up and said, "Come with me, my friend." But then he ended up beating the case. He was a really bright
jailhouse attorney.
Jailhouse lawyer.
That he was, because he sat in that cell. I watched him do it. I asked him one time, foolishly, "Why are you doing all this studying? What's the purpose of this?" And he just told me, "Well, there's no reason. It's just filling in time." Well, he had a plan the whole time, but he always played like it, nothing mattered. It was no big deal. And that was part of the act, is to put people like me, I just say, "Oh, well, he's just, you know, he's just a hobby. He's just reading the book." No, he's planning how to overturn his conviction. And he's studying on this, and he's concentrating. I think that's one of the things that he's got the ability to do, is narrow down all the static that's going on around him, because he's in a place where there's a guy down the three cells down screaming his head off constantly. He can just shut that out, concentrate on what he's working on, and make it look nonchalant, even though it's a very serious study for him.
You guys must have had a pretty decent law library in that penitentiary for the inmates. Is that correct?
No, we didn't.
How did he get access to legal text to the reporters and everything that you need to? And by reporters, that's a technical term or term of art for a law book that has past cases with precedents. He must have had some access to those kinds of books.
He did, and the way it worked is each cell house or each range on a cell house would have this one cell, and we called it the law library. It's a cell, 5 foot by 8 foot, same size cell that he's in. And we put a little shelf in there, and it's got 50 books in there or something, and it's all the very basic stuff. And it, we give him a typewriter, pens, paper, that kind of stuff. And from that basic law library, he was looking up cases for precedents. And then he can order the volumes through our education department, and then they'll send him whatever he wants. It's nothing like we can do now, where you can just sit down at a computer, type in some stuff, and it pops up. For him, all this stuff had to take, he really had to have some patience. You had to ask for a book. You only got one or two books at a time. And he got out of it what he could, and he would have to copy it by hand, because you don't just put this thing on the photocopying machine. Then he would send those books back and get the other set that he wanted, and just it was just constant like that. And the same with non-legal books. He would have to order so many at a time. That's just the way it went. I mean, you were very limited in what you could have at any one time. But if you had enough patience, and like he did, if you had enough patience, you could get everything that you wanted. It just took 10 times longer than it would take anybody else.
Well, Martin had nothing but time on his hands. His sentence wasn't even going to be up until like 2078 or something like that. Like, he was probably not going to live to see the outside of, you know, the free world if he had not been able to do something to reduce his own sentence.
Yeah, that was common. We had people doing all that they could, and 98% of the time they couldn't do anything about it. But every once in a while, I mean, I've seen an inmate that was given, he had committed a murder in Oregon, told me all about it. It's kind of some of the stuff that I would talk to inmates about. I'd say, well, how did your case work? And I would adapt what they told me to my personal life. You know, like, wow, I got a lawsuit with somebody. How does this work and how does that work? And I would talk to the inmates, and they would explain to me what was going on with their case. Because, one, they like to do it, and, two, I learned something from it. Guy in Oregon committed a murder. He was sentenced to on federal time, so they put him back in a federal system, and they never did the punishment phase of his trial. 10 years later, he's going to be kicked out of the federal system, and now they want to do the punishment phase. Well, he found some little quirk in the law or some precedence where it said, you know, it's unfair to do that because he doesn't have the ability to defend himself, to show his side of it in the penalty phase. And so he ended up getting convicted of murder with no penalty. He walked scot-free on a murder. We had a few cases like that. I've seen that before.
Well, the ingenuity of people, whether they're prisoners or individuals out here, is if they've got enough focus and a few brains, you can come up with a lot of stuff in the law. But it takes so much focus and so much patience to read through all that stuff. I know. I've been there. I've done that. It's really difficult. Now Mac, he partnered up. He buddied up with this Trapnell guy. What's his full name?
Gordon Brock Trapnell.
Trapnell. He buddied up with him, and they were both skyjackers. I find that fascinating. These two skyjackers in the whole penitentiary system buddied up and then came up with a plan to escape.
I'm sorry, I was wrong. It's Garrett Brock Trapnell.
Garrett Brock Trapnell. Now, he was the Trapnell. You mentioned before we actually went on the air that he was there when you were there also, but he was in a special wing built just for him. What do you remember about him?
Well, they had a unit called K unit, and K unit was on the bottom floor of the hospital. It was completely isolated from the rest of the prison. And the idea was he was the rotten apple in the barrel. And so they wanted to segregate him from most of the other prisoners. So they put him in a special unit so that he could be watched continuously. And I think they ended up having four or five other prisoners there. They had Jonathan Pollard, the spy, and they had John Walker, another the Navy spy. And they had a couple of other prisoners in there, and the idea was to keep an eye on Trapnell so that he wouldn't do another one of these helicopter escapes and get assistance from other inmates like he had with McNally. So they wanted to segregate him from those kinds of people. So McNally's ended up in G unit, which is 150 yards away, but it's like being on another planet, so that they can't cooperate anymore. And Trapnell is in a unit with a bunch of intellectual spy kind of people, so they're not men of action, and he can't motivate anybody to assist him anymore. And that was the purpose. And this K unit, you had to be specially cleared to work there. Nobody had the key to the even the front door of the thing. I had to go and request permission from a supervisor so that the control center would issue me the key just so I could go down there and open the door and give them people food or replace the officer that was in there for the shift. As far as I know, I was told that the director of the Bureau of Prisons was the only person that would allow inmates into or out of that unit. It was that control. They'd really gotten tired of Trapnell, and they buried him down there in K unit. And when Trapnell died, the same week that happened, all the other inmates were transferred out, and the unit was closed. So that's how I know that it was special just for him.
Well, they must have had it. You know, they needed to segregate him from the other prisoners, like Martin J. McNally, but they also, you know, because people could still come in, they had visitation rights, and Garrett Brock Trapnell, definitely a smooth talker.
Well, he talked one lady into believing that he was her father, and so she ends up hijacking an aircraft because Dad told her to do it.
Well, there was,
I mean, that's a pretty smooth talker.
There was, I've got two breakout attempts listed in the Wikipedia for Trapnell here. One of them was from 43-year-old Barbara Ann Oswald, who hijacked the helicopter out of St. Louis that we talked with Martin about. And then the second hijacking was, oddly enough, Barbara Ann Oswald's daughter, Robin Oswald, who hijacked a plane on Garrett Brock Trapnell's smooth talking. I mean, that's just amazing. I could see why you'd want to isolate him, you know, with spies, because they're not going to believe his dialogue. And then the other thing I would always be watching, like, well, who's visiting him, right? Because I don't remember him ever getting a visitor. Yeah, I would think
as far as I know,
a tangent as being a guard at Marion Prison would be that you had a lot of these ladies that wanted to help reform some of these bad inmates.
Now,
you know, that did happen occasionally. Like, we'd get telephone calls from somebody that you know, you let that Dottie loose, he's a nice guy, and I talked to him, and it was usually just bogus. She never talked to Dottie because he didn't call her. He only ever called his family.
I would call and say, oh yeah, I talked to Gotti, and he really isn't guilty of any of this stuff. You should let him go.
Yeah.
And you're like, you're a dude.
You know, I think with Trapnell on that, he probably got sent there, and they made that unit after that second escape attempt. I think after the first one, they didn't immediately slap him into that special unit, because I saw there's a documentary on YouTube, and I can't remember the name of the true crime show that did it. Stacy Keach was the narrator, I believe. But they indicated that he had several meetings in the prison with Robin Oswald, the daughter, and they set up this whole escape attempt. Probably after that came out, because she gave up. She pretended like she had dynamite, like a suicide vest on, and then she gave up. And when she gave up, she, of course, had already asked that Trapnell be released as part of her, you know, hijacking and demands of the FBI or the government. That's probably when they said, you know, this is enough. This guy is going in the hole, the real hole.
That's the way I've always heard it, is that Trapnell was such a manipulative individual that he talked the mom into believing that she was in love with him and that they were going to go and go off to paradise together hand in hand and everything was going to be really great. And then she was killed. So he ended up talking the daughter into, well, I'm really your father. And, you know, the mother, I don't know what conversation the mother and daughter had prior to her demise, but she ended up falling for this and saying, oh, well, I'm going to break daddy out. And then that was the second escape attempt. And it was like, oh, my God, how could somebody fall for this? But obviously they did. He was a very manipulative person. When I would talk to him, he was always digging for information. You know, he would ask questions in such a way that I would give up personal information. And it was like, wow, you just can't ask this guy, would you like a spoon to stir your coffee, without having to think about that there was some hidden motive behind what he said back to you. There was always something going on.
Interesting. I've known people like that, but not to quite to that extent. But I know what you mean. It's a constant battle of wits almost with them to keep them from finding out some kind of information about you that they can somehow turn to use to their advantage. It's like you'd make a hell of a good car salesman, I'd say.
Yeah, that was what's going on. And then at the same time, when you matched that McNally with him, McNally was the nuts and bolts guy.
Yeah.
You had to restrict the information that was going into that cell because it was the same sort of thing, except he's not looking for information about you. He's looking about information about the physical plants of the place, how things work, or as diverse as the court system and all of those things. He had all this stuff going. So I was always worried about every time I saw McNally go into the book box and pick up a novel, I would think there's something in that damn novel that he's going to be able to use against us. I don't know what it is, but I know there's something in there.
Well, he is quite a guy. You know, I and as you know, you know him too. You know him better than I do in a way. You spent more time with him, but we spent a whole day with him, and I've had some ongoing email conversations about a variety of different things, and he is a really likable guy. I mean, I truly like that guy. Now, I probably know enough not to let my guard down too far, but he is really a likable guy and bright. I mean, he is come out of the after spending 42 years in the penitentiary system from the time he was young until he's old, basically, and he's surviving on his own. And you know, I don't know if he's prospering or not, but I know he is definitely surviving and you know, thriving in a way, in his own way. What
as much as could be done, yes, he thrived. He was able to provide services for other inmates that other people couldn't do, and so that gave him an advantage.
Go ahead.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
I had to not only worry about what he was doing, but if he wanted something that he knew that people like me were eyeballing and going, he's going to use that against me. Well, what he'd do is he'd get somebody else to get it for him and give it to him. So that, of course, I'm going to say, oh, that guy over there, he's a moron. It doesn't matter what the hell he's reading or looking into. He's an idiot. But yeah, he's an idiot, but he's working for McNally.
He always wanted that copy of Gone with the Wind.
Everything with that guy is like you're peeling back the layers. What he's presenting to me is, hey, I'm just a regular guy, and everything is cool, and I really don't care about anything. And that's not even close to the real story. The real story is I'm researching something. I've got this plot going, and I'm going to make it appear that I've got nothing at all. And it's like, oh, my God. You know, even after he left, we would talk amongst ourselves, and then we could piece things together. And at one point, I remember sitting around with a three or four of my friends, and I said, oh, my God, he was playing the stock market. And they were like, no, he wasn't. Yeah, you know what that guy said and this guy said and these other guys said? Map all this together, and if you look at it as one picture, you can see exactly what's happening. He's playing the stock market from his cell. Oh, my God. I wonder how much money he made, because you know he didn't do it well, and lose money.
Well, he did allude when we were with him, and after we did the whole session and we were out, we took him out to dinner there, and he did allude that he had some money to invest and looking maybe to buy some apartments or something. I don't know if that was because he played the stock market, but did he ever talk about any other hijackers?
No. No, he would... He would be the actually the opposite of that. He would do the old, what are you talking about?
Right.
I've never heard of that kind of thing. You know, it's because, see, the Martin McNally that you met or the Martin McNally that I could meet tomorrow is a different Martin McNally than I met in the prison. There, the game is on. It's live. You know, he can't make a misstep. He's got his agenda, and I have my job to do, and I don't hold it against him or anybody else. They got what they need to do, and I respect that. They also respect that I've got to do what I've got to do. Inside the prison, it's a long, drawn out battle between them and us. They want to manipulate us or improve their living conditions, escape, commit other crimes. All those kinds of things are constantly going on with the inmates, and it's my job to prevent that. The Martin McNally that I'm talking about is the Martin McNally that was trying to do all those things, and I was trying to prevent it. So the one that you met and the one that I met is different guys. He don't have to do that anymore. I don't see any... There's no advantage for him to get himself into trouble again.
Well, he's certainly not going to admit to anything that he may be charged with again, you know, because some offenses have no statute of limitations, like air piracy. Like we asked.
The death that caused from it, you know, because he was in a conspiracy to escape and there was a death involved. The pilot killed the lady, and so he could be held responsible for it.
I know that I asked him directly if he was D.B. Cooper, and he just kind of laughed and said no. But he seemed like a guy who knew a lot about jumping out of a plane at the time he described his experience jumping out of a plane.
So what do you think, David? Could he be D.B. Cooper, and he just won't admit it to us?
Because it's a lifetime sentence he'll never get to outrun.
No, I don't think so. And the reason I don't think so is that he said that he had studied the D.B. Cooper case, and that's what really gave him the idea. And he thought that he was going to put some improvements on it. Plus,
that's what he told us.
I'm from the county that D.B. Cooper parachuted into. That's my home county.
Mm-hmm.
We think he's dead. Let's see, it was February of 1980. A bunch of his money washed up on the banks of the Columbia River in Portland, Oregon. Just like Martin, he ended up getting separated from his money.
Yeah.
D.B. Cooper did. And I think if he was D.B. Cooper, he would have learned from that experience and made sure that him and his money wasn't separated. Oh, well, that's another reason I don't think it was him.
Well, did Martin ever tell you that he happened to be a crew member on a P-3 anti-submarine plane that flew out of Whidbey Island Naval Air Station?
No, he never told me that.
Yeah, and he told us that.
And I think he was.
He told me he was in the Navy and left it at that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's what he did. Aaron even kind of checked on that story, and he did do that.
But, you know, as anybody would admit, that nobody knows what happened to D.B. Cooper. And certainly Martin never going to come forward unless it maybe is, Martin, you're listening to this, if it's on your deathbed, I don't know where else you would actually come forward and say it if it were in fact the case. If it's not, you know, there's some great similarities, you know, that if you look at the FBI sketches and the young Martin McNally, and then there's some aged FBI sketches, and you look at the photos of Gary with Martin or myself with Martin, strikingly similar.
Well, I don't know. It makes a good story. Anyhow, David, how about any other Mac stories?
On that, what you're saying about McNally, if he was to trick me, to fool me into not believing something, it would not surprise me. So I am well aware that he has been scamming me for years, and I was too ignorant notice that. So if you're telling me that he's got one more scam over on me, I wouldn't be surprised.
I wouldn't be surprised.
He could be pulling the wool over everybody's eyes right now.
I think he realized that I was paying extra special attention to him. And so one of the things I did was I searched his cell one day, and he either made up or it's true that he had a catalog for something, and he had some sort of business thing going that he shouldn't have had done. And either I did or I didn't, or if I did, I didn't do it on purpose. I confiscated his catalog. I have no knowledge of it, or I don't have any memory of it. And it came to be a big sticking point because that guy filed all kinds of complaints and appeals of complaints. And he made it so that I finally said, you know what, I am sick of working in this unit because that guy down there is constantly filling out a piece of paper with my name on it. And I've had to sit in interviews with the Office of Inspection, the Attorney General's office. I mean, just thing after thing after thing. He, if he wanted to get rid of me, he did a good job.
that would be like my.
He knew how. He knew how to work
and
the system.
Like I say, I don't hold it against him.
Yeah.
I would have done the same thing if I was him. It was just all part of the game, the system. So, you know, he was effective at what he did. I have to admire anybody that's good at what they do.
That's for sure. And David, I would say that. You
want to get rid of me?
Yeah, that speaks to your skills and abilities as a correctional officer. I would say if Mac needed to get you out of there because he felt like if you were gone, he could operate a little freer, I got a feeling.
Yeah, and that's the way I took it. So in a way, I took it as a compliment. Wow, I must be kind of effective.
Well, folks, this has been most interesting. David, can you come back and talk about John Gotti and some mob guys next week with us?
Certainly. No problem.
All right, great.
What was the name of his YouTube channel again?
It was As the Key Turns. So, folks, just go to YouTube and search for As the Key Turns, and there's a ton of videos of David talking about stories from the Marion Penitentiary. They're interesting, and he tells you every in and out and angle of the prisoners and the system and how that works, something that really I've never seen before. I've never seen a book or a movie or a documentary that really went into the nuts and bolts of what went on in what goes on in the federal penitentiary system. There's a lot of coppers and FBI agents, DEA agents, ATF agents that have written books about their life, and I've never seen one by a federal correctional guard. Have you ever seen one by a federal correctional guard, David?
The only one I ever saw was by a guy that did it 40 years after Alcatraz closed.
Yeah.
That's the only one I've ever seen. I've never seen any modern ones.
Yeah, I didn't think so. I've never seen one. So maybe you got a book in you. You can just take all those the audio from those videos and transcribe it and make it into a book almost.
He's got notes for all those videos. He could just use that.
Right.
Make a Kindle.
That actually was the idea of As the Key Turns, is to take all of that, those memories, and eventually add something to them, boil them down, and turn them into a book.
Cool. Well, we'll look forward to that maybe one of these days, and we'll talk to you again, especially if you ever get started on that book and get the message out about your book. We're going to wind this down now, and we will look forward to talking to you next week, David.
Okay, I look forward to it.
All right. Folks, if you have a friend or relative who has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call the first call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, folks, you need to get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available for rent or purchase on Amazon. And then after you're done watching that, you're going to want to know more. So then you want to go out and get the Kansas City Mob Tour app. For $1.99, you can take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. And if that's not enough, you need to get Gary's latest book,
leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
And remember to share, subscribe, and support Gangland Wire. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button.
Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron. Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.
And if you had any copy to read. He seems pretty good here. I'd just like to see what your level looks like, Gary.
Got mine? Okay. Yeah, Wesley, we try to get these levels where they're about even. And one thing you need to know is we edit this, so this isn't live. And so I can cut out all the uhs and ahs, and especially for me and anybody else or anything, if we make a mistake, we just go back in. When I edit, I'll cut all that out. So,
that's great, because I go, a
yeah,
lot.
Yeah, I do too. You don't realize how many times that you do that or have some little idiosyncratic thing that we may say, like a lot of people will say okay a lot, or they'll say, you know, well, that's fine, and when I'm face-to-face with you, may not pay any attention to it, but boy, when you're just listening to somebody and they're going on, I've taken a lot of those out, those kinds of things. So it's like I say, a lot. I've taken a lot of those out for other people, and it's starting to jump out more at me that I do that.
Yeah, I've had to learn how not to do that, because when I'm doing these YouTube videos, people just get sick of hearing that.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I know what you mean. Do you? You don't edit those at all, though, do you? You do a pretty good job.
Yeah, that's pretty hard to edit the ums out.
Especially when you got the video going. That's why I don't do any video.
Yeah, I have to do them 3 to 4 times. Because
I see.
If I put the first take most of the time, and I've gotten to where I don't even turn the camera on for the first 2 times.
Oh, really? Interesting.
So, I don't know if you're reading copy.
Yeah, otherwise it's all and then I learned that there's a bunch of stuff that I couldn't remember. So I've got to, like, underneath my camera, I don't know if you'll notice me, but there's a bunch of notes there with names on it, because, like, I'll just get stuck and I can't remember somebody's name.
Yeah, I know. I feel your pain, brother. I feel your pain. I don't know how many times I've done that.
I want to say there's probably, I don't know if he has an iPad or an Android, there's probably some kind of a teleprompter app.
Oh, yeah.
That'll read text. And if you get, like I've got that little arm kind of grappler thing that you could, so you could set it right in front of you behind the camera so you actually could kind of look at your tablet or whatever. Like when Gary talks, the phone or the Skype that we're using is kind of off slightly to his right, and he tends to turn his head a little bit into as he's talking to you. And, you know, so when we get copy and he's reading the copy, I try to get it right in front of, right behind his microphone.
Yeah.
That'd be the same with the video.
Yeah, that sounds like something I probably ought to get.
You might look at that.
All I've been doing is just taping a note underneath the camera.
Yeah, well, that works too.
That's pretty high-tech.
Unless you're squinting at it. I don't have very good distance vision without my glasses. And I don't have very good close vision with them.
Yeah, I did that once in a documentary film. I went back in. I realized I was a little shy on some facts. And I didn't have the guy that really knew the facts off the top of his head, but I had somebody that should know them. So I just wrote out in really large letters on three different pieces of paper, and then held them up. I got behind the camera. He got in front of him, and then I just held him up one at a time as he then basically read off those facts like he was, spontaneously reciting those facts. I felt kind of bad about it, but, you know, it's show business, folks. It's show business.
Yeah, and I can't remember all that stuff. There's a lot of, I don't know, technical stuff, you know, like, a certain date, the unit that something happened in, or, you know, I'll research it. Sometimes I even talk to my friends and say, you know, was that, what unit was that in? What guy was that? Because I've got for us anyway, it was pretty famous. This guy got stabbed in the shower, and I got the name of the inmate wrong. They look similar, and everybody I talked to said, no, it ain't the guy that you think it is. It's this other guy. And I didn't believe the first two of them, but after the third person said the same thing. I'm like, well, okay, I'm wrong.
Yeah.
That's why you need a guy like me.
We got Aaron to say, well, wait a minute.
Was that right? Wasn't he this or that? And then Gary would be like, no, that was something else.
We've done that too. But I say, Wesley, I say never let the facts get in the way of a good story. So I forge on.
Well, and having the bonus of it only being audio, that part of it can always be cut right out.
Yeah. Or people will listen to it. It's somebody that really knows the facts, a stickler for the facts, will listen to it. But if he can't go back and just glance up and reread it and say, no, he got that wrong, they won't even notice that it was wrong. Although I did get caught dirty by two different people on saying the Five Points area of Manhattan became Hell's Kitchen. And boy, I had two guys. Actually, one guy got on my gave a one-star review, the only one-star review I got on iTunes for my podcast, and that was his sentence. When he wouldn't listen to a podcast where the host did not know the difference between Five Points and Hell's Kitchen in Manhattan.
Gee.
So he was a bit harsh, I thought.
He gave us one shot, and that was it.
That was it.
So get the... You know, and sometimes we'll be talking with somebody, you know, and it was like Andrew DiDonato, where he's talking about, was it part of Brooklyn that they were, right? They were like racing through with this chopped up remains of a car. And I, you know, he's like, and then I got to this intersection. I didn't think I was going to make it through. And I go, you can't really say much because, you know, it's like, well, I don't really know New York, so let me just listen.
That's all you got to do is listen. We're in the entertainment business here. I don't expect anybody to footnote a academic work to what I do.
Well, but you want to kind of get the, like what he's saying, getting the facts right. I tell that sort of that story where I think I found Frank Calabrese on Twitter, and it wasn't actually the Frank Calabrese Jr. that we had talked to. And so then I had to kind of go back and delete that tweet. I didn't want to upset that guy.
Well, who cares about that guy?
You would think that a lot of people probably ask him that question.
Well, you know he gets that all the time. You're going to have a name like Frank Calabrese Jr., one of the most famous in recent years mob turncoats who testified against his father, and you're going to go up and put your name out there like that. You're going to get lots of mistaken identities.
Oh, yeah, that'd be for sure.
Really?
All right. Well, do you want to... get him to do a liner.
Go ahead.
That, this John Gotti fight thing that I saw a piece of.
Yeah.
I looked this up just to, you know, kind of make sure my facts are right. Oh my God, there is 80% of this stuff just seems like rumors or people that made up stuff and they're calling each other all liars, and they're worried about these little minuscule things. And it's like, this is until I got into this, I didn't realize that there was, first of all, I never realized there was people that actually gave a crap about the mob.
Yeah.
Prisoners that I dealt with, they were just people to us, just prisoners. They were just another guy. And I didn't know that... until I went to New York, I seen a guy that had painted a picture of Gotti while he was sitting there on the sidewalk. And I'm like, hell, that dude is dead, man. And this guy was like, oh, and then he told me all about Gotti. I was afraid to tell him, well, yeah, I met the guy. You know,
oh, God, you'd be like a god to somebody like that. That's a great thing about having you on this podcast to tell that story, because like I said, I've seen all that stuff you just talked about, and there's tons of people that act like they know something, and somebody else that thinks they know something different, and then they want to get these little wars, especially about the Gottis. They're like a lightning rod among these mob fans. It's unbelievable.
Well, you know, I tell the story, I put it out, but I'm wondering if I ought to tell it here, because I'll get a bunch of hate mail out of this.
We'll take that for you.
Aficionados of the mafia
detest
the fact that I burned up one of his meals on purpose.
That's a good one. We got to tell that one on this. I'll get the hate mail later. They won't know exactly. Well, of course, we're going to pump up your YouTube channel, so you'll probably get some comments on that. The craziest commenters are on YouTube. Have you ever noticed that?
All the time.
For my Facebook page, And personally, I've had a couple of people go after me personally, but that was more personal, more in Kansas City related. But the Facebook page, I get some crazy comments on that. They're like the loons come out on that Facebook page sometimes, more so than YouTube, more than the Facebook.
Yeah, I get a bunch because, I'm a terrible guy because I burned up his meal and, that kind of stuff.
That's a good one.
Were you happen to be working there when Pete Rose was incarcerated?
He was.
I'm looking here at the I'm looking at the Wikipedia page, and they've got a list of, the mob folks, organized crime terrorists. Pete Rose is certainly under the others.
Yeah. I didn't.
Garrett Brock Trapnell, of course.
Yeah, you know Garrett Brock Trapnell, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was in the K unit. They actually had a unit, K unit, and it was specifically for him. They put a few other people in there, like, John Walker, the spy, and Trapnell, the spy, and some other spies and ex CIA agents and that kind of stuff down there with him, but it was really for him. They just put other people down there because they said, "Well, we can't have a one-man unit."
Oh, interesting.
So, yeah, I knew him.
Was it the only unit with a helicopter pad on the roof?
Yeah, that happened like in the early '80s, and people talked about that when I was there in the late '80s and early '90s, like it was yesterday.
Oh, you weren't there when they actually did the escape attempt. I was thinking you were.
No, that was 4 or 5 years before I got there.
Okay, all right. Well, you can talk about a little bit about what people said about it. I'm sure we want to kind of touch on that a little bit.
But he was also there when Martin was there.
Yeah, he knew Martin personally.
I knew them guys.
Why don't we
personally? But they weren't in escape mode when I knew them.
Yeah, they were over that. They was over that, wasn't they? Okay.
Well, like check
the mic on
that. Came
side.
Up with better ideas and said, "Well, we're going to get a gun that shoots down helicopters, and we're going to put this wire up all over the place," and that didn't quite work out for them. The prisoners, damn them prisoners! They think about what you're doing, and they sit in there and they contemplate because they got plenty of time to do this, and they figured out, hey, they're stretching up all this wire around here. So what we'll do. is we'll get a piece of fishing line from some guy, and God knows where they turned it up. Probably some guy brought it in his lunchbox, and they stole it. And they threw it over that wire that they put up for the helicopters, and then they ended up stretching it between two units so that they could pass notes back and forth. And up in the air, 30 feet, you can't see this little bitty piece of fishing wire.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so they were doing that to communicate. And the only reason I found out about it was the outside patrolman, they got this guy, he walks around on the inside, he checks doors and locks and et cetera, et cetera. He said, "Hey, come over here to the window." Well, I went over to the window, and he goes, "Look up there." And I said, "What do you see?" He goes, "Look, there's a bird sitting there. You see that bird? And there's this bird just sitting in the air. He's not flapping his wings.
I see.
There. And it's like, what the hell? Is he levitating or what? And finally, we got at the right angle where we could see a little glint off that super thin fishing line. And I'm like, oh, my God, it's tied to the window. So I went up the stairs, found the spot where it was tied, and cut the thing.
That is a good one.
If that bird hadn't sit on it, I would have never seen that thing.
Really? Interesting.
So everything that we did to stop something caused something else.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Okay, Aaron, you ready to do a liner?
Yeah, let's. Why don't we have him do a liner here? And
Wesley, here's what we like to do. You could say your whole name or part of your name or whatever you want to be known as. You'd say this is so and so, and
YouTube channel.
You might want to try my YouTube channel. Turn the key, and you're listening to Gangland Wire. Just say a little bit of something about yourself and your YouTube channel, and then you're listening to Gangland Wire. Then I'll plug that in two or three times later on in the year. So it's kind of a little ongoing plug. It'll be at the very start of another podcast.
Oh, well, I usually don't use my name or anybody else's associated with me.
That's fine.
So I just say, I used to be a prison guard for 23 years at USP Marion, and I kind of go like that.
They don't. You don't have an actual name on your turn the key. As the key turns.
No. And how do you want me to refer to you as on this?
Well, that's a good question.
Just maybe a first name.
My middle name is David. I have occasionally used that if I have to have a name.
Well, it might make it easier. It just seems a little awkward not to be able to say something. So would David be okay?
Yeah, let's try that.
Okay, all right. Go ahead you just kind of come up with something off the top of your head, and I, like I said, I can edit it as to identify, you know, that you have this as the Key Turns YouTube channel, the stories of the Marion Penitentiary or Marion Prison, and you're listening to Gangland Wire. Just the main thing, okay. If you add, you know, say anything you want about yourself and your YouTube channel, and then say, and you're listening to Gangland Wire.
Gotcha.
Ready? 3, 2, 1.
My name is David, and for 23 years, I worked at the United States Penitentiary at Marion, Illinois. I was a guard or a correctional officer, as I'm officially known, and I tell stories about my experiences during those 23 years behind the wire on As the Key Turns on YouTube, and you're listening to Gangland Wire.
Great. That's a cut. You're a one-take wonder, my friend. David, I need to start calling you David so I can get that in my head.
Write that down.
I've written it down here in front of me.
That's what I do. I got a bunch of notes of people's names here, so I don't know. Okay.
All right, Aaron, you ready? You're going to do the whole lead-in? He'll bring the mics down and he'll play a little music so we get the feel of it's a live thing, although it's really not. And then we'll come up and I'll introduce the podcast and myself, and then we'll introduce you in.
Okay, sounds good.
Yeah, bring your mic down.